See, what I'm saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. About a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. But what we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands. Africa Live. Just raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshetela. Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
Uhuru and welcome to Africa Live, Voices of the People, here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we, as usual, have Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee, with us, though today we will not have Chairman Omali Eshetela joining us in the studio, but we're going to keep it moving anyway. Uhuru, Penny.
Uhuru, Nyabinga. It's an honor to be here, as always.
Good to have you. Just to kick it off, well, first of all, we're going to be talking about a few things today, including the economic crisis and what's going on in occupied Palestine. And later on, we'll be speaking with Colonel Alpha Mba, the director of organization of the African Socialist International, about, the military coup that, recently happened in Guinea-Conakry. And so we'll be talking about that later on in the second half of the show. But right now, let's kick it off and talk about occupied Palestine, where the illegitimate settler state of Israel has intensified its massacre of the Palestinian people with the launch of a ground invasion on yesterday. Let's play a clip from a BBC report covering this invasion.
At first light, the Israeli ground offensive was gaining momentum. The clear mission to stop rocket attacks by Hamas. With international calls for a ceasefire failing, there's no political imperative for either side to stop fighting. Barrages of fire, black smoke from the wreckage, and thousands of Israeli troops moving towards Gaza City. Israel says it's killed and wounded dozens of militants. The Palestinians say civilians, including children, have died. As best they could, Palestinian emergency services ferried the injured to already overstretched hospitals. With the overall offensive now more than a week old, doctors are expecting many more wounded with no respite. In the southern Gaza town of Rafah, residents packed their personal belongings and left their homes in fear that the Israeli ground incursion would eventually reach them, while Palestinian leaders called for an immediate end to the offensive.
I believe the focus should be on one thing at this particular point, and that is to stop all attacks against Gaza from Israel. We believe once this is achieved, we can talk about all other issues.
The military escalation to a ground attack began at dusk on Saturday. One Palestinian relief worker spent the night huddled in his basement with his family.
We were living in total darkness, and the weather was really very chilling. I think such military operations have to be stopped.
But not yet, says the Israeli cabinet, arguing that there was no escape from launching the ground campaign. But there was a recognition of the international concern about civilians.
We are not fighting against the civilians. We look for the Hamas soldiers and terrorists.
For its part, Hamas went on air with images of the Israeli prime minister and a coffin draped in the Israeli flag. Soon, you will be carried away in this box, was the message. In the first hours of the offensive, Israel's wounded began arriving back from Gaza, where they'd been up against Hamas roadside bombs, weapons and mortar fire. In southern Israel, the target of the Hamas rockets, the incursion has been widely welcomed.
We feel excellent when Israeli army inside in Gaza, and that we believe that he will do excellent work that we need against the terror organization.
Israel says it will expand the operation and intensify it as much as necessary. Humphrey Hawksley, BBC News.
You gotta just love the way the BBC can twist reality and turn it into something completely different from what it really is on the ground. Of course, I say that sarcastically, because you can't love that unless you are down with the oppression of the majority of people of the world. But it's interesting to see how they paint this picture of these heroic Israeli soldiers returning from Gaza. You know. these heroic wounded soldiers returning from Gaza where they faced such difficult things, this mortar attacks and all of these and roadside bombs from Hamas forces. It's this picture is it's a sickening kind of thing that they're painting. You know, while these guys are massacring masses of people, you know, children, women, you know, men, elderly folks, you know, and then at the same time they found as they often do in the African community in the U.S. they find one colonized person who they can get to say, oh, well, we welcome the colonizers. We welcome the assault, the murder of our people. You know, it's a really sickening kind of thing that they do. Penny, I don't know if you want to add.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's an outrage that this, you know, ongoing assault is happening and that it's intensifying in this way. And there have been demonstrations all around the world. There was I was able to watch Al Jazeera live this morning online, and they had clips of demonstrations around the world. I think there was 20,000 people in France and, you know, and certainly in Britain, and even in San Francisco, I think there were 10,000 people. There was even a pretty good demonstration here in St. Petersburg last night. But from the clips that I saw, which is not necessarily, you know, the whole thing, but it looked like it was majority Arab people who were demonstrating, you know, the Europeans, the white people. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much of a stand that's been, although I'm sure there has been some. But the things that I can see that are really important about it are, you know, I mean, first of all, we have to acknowledge that the land belongs to the Palestinian people.
Yes.
It is not a shared thing. It's, you know, the land was stolen by imperialist-backed Israel as, you know, the interview played just in the hour before this, the chairman with the top level of representative of the DFLP of Palestine was really informative and was great to hear again. I know that was from several years ago, from, I think, the second Intifada. But, you know, it goes back to remind us that the land was chosen by the imperialists as an imperialist stronghold. I mean, even then they knew the oil-rich Middle East that you know, back in the early 1900s, that they were going to need that resource. That's one thing. And strategically, they wanted to have an imperialist puppet right there in the Middle East that could terrorize Arabs as well as Northern Africa and, you know, and be stationed right there. It's really clear that that's what it is. And when you look at the map of Israel and you see that Gaza is just a little strip right on the Mediterranean, very valuable land that they want that strip. So, you know, it's worth a lot of money. And I think that, you know, there's 1.4 million Palestinian people living there. So it's very, very crowded. And this assault is killing children and the civilian population. They were interviewing on Al Jazeera doctors at the hospitals, and the hospitals are just overflowing with thousands of people injured and wounded, near death. And the doctors were saying it was totally civilian population, you know. That's what this is about, terror, as the Palestinian people are in a struggle for national liberation, to regain their land. And as much as imperialism thinks that this will go away or that they can wipe it out, it's every time, you know, they attack it, they're strengthening it. They're strengthening the determination of the Arab people and all freedom and justice-loving people around the world that the Palestinians have the right to their land and to their independence and self-determination. So I think that it's saying that they have no electricity right now. Gaza has been divided militarily by the assault. Israel divided it so that Gaza City cannot, you know, people from Gaza City cannot get to Rafah and the other cities on the other end of the strip. Also, one of the things that it seems notable is I'm seeing more of a mention from articles and also on clips that I see of Arab people denouncing the sellout leaders like Mubarak of Egypt, who's really just been a dog, a complete neocolonialist. And while I haven't yet exactly seen the term neocolonialist, I think that there is this understanding that the masses of the Arab people are increasingly angry and disgruntled with their leadership, and that this represents a real, you know, destabilization of the kind of neocolonialism that the U.S. has counted on in the Middle East to have a kind of balance of power in the favor of the U.S. You know, even in Saudi Arabia, there's anger against the Saudi family. You know, this is really important, and it just continues to expose that. As the party says, as the chairman says, that neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism, and that is breaking down in this. The reports, you know, that I saw on Al Jazeera, the people are saying that this is strengthening Hamas, that it, you know, they can kill the leaders, but they have more people, you know, thousands of more people who want to come in and join the struggle. And calling for a third intifada means that Arab people from all over the planet will come back to Israel to occupied Palestine to wage the struggle against Israel.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's, you know, first of all, we support, the Uhuru movement supports the struggle of the Palestinian people without reserve to regain control of their own land. And you know, it's interesting to see, you know, that despite the economic crisis that the U.S. imperialism is facing, that it still it is not stopped funding, you know, Israel. It's a statement of the significance it sees in Israel's role for U.S. interests in that region. You know, to be able to, you know, have a stranglehold in that region. Now, it's also interesting, you know, you look at this thing and, you know, it can't end well. There's no way that this can end well. Not for anybody, not for Israel. To function in that area in this kind of way, you know, first of all, occupying force can only occupy, you know, an area for so long, you know, before they're overthrown, you know. And the way that Israel functions in that region, the genocidal wars, that the genocidal actions that it does, you know, you can only imagine that, you know, the response, you know, is gonna be, you know, people wanting to get rid of that thing.
Yeah. Right. And I think that it's really it's really interesting, like you're saying, here's imperialism in crisis, and to, you know, understand African internationalism, which tells us that imperialism or capitalism is parasitic. It's born on the enslavement of African and oppressed people. It's born on the theft of people's land and self-determination and resources, and it's maintained that way. And as we, you know, we look at the world now and we look at the crisis that imperialism is in, it's clear that it's intensifying its attacks on the people of the world. And I think it's interesting that, of course, the Bush administration blamed Hamas and has come out really, really strongly in that. But here's Obama. His only comment is no comment on it. Saying there should only be one president at the time. Well, wait a minute. He's already put out his economic plan. He's already made statements on other things, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and other things that were happening. And we know that he went down on his knees to Israel just hours after he won the primary and gave a presentation at AIPAC. We know that he's, you know, named Rahm Emanuel, actual Zionist, grew up in Israel. His father fought in the Zionist occupying army as his chief of staff. And the envoy that is being designated for to the Middle East is said to be Dennis Ross. This would be under Hillary Clinton, who also is a devoted Zionist. And Dennis Ross is also an active Zionist who actually goes around to synagogues and talks about support for Israel and that kind of thing, you know, drumming up support for it all the time. And he's said to have written the speech, the presentation that Obama gave to the AIPAC Israel lobby in June, I think it was. So, yeah. You know, this is really clear what his stand-in is. So change, I mean, I've already seen articles where the Palestinian people are saying, you know, just denouncing Obama, saying there's, you know, it's really clear. This is no change. Same old imperialism.
Yes.
Same old, same old. And I think that is a really important point. And also that I think it's important that for North Americans and Europeans to, first of all, take the stand, but of the people that do take the stand, we have to recognize that occupied Palestine is right here.
Yes.
And we don't have to just feel our outrage when we see it there, although we have to take that stand, and we must take that stand, but to recognize that stolen land, well, this is stolen land of the indigenous people.
Yes.
Border walls, we have them.
Yes.
Against, you know, as part of of a terror against the Mexican people, indigenous Mexican people coming back to reclaim their land and resources that have been stolen from them. Torture, terror, we have it right here in these prison camps that have 2.5 million people in prison, most of them African and Mexican.
Yes.
You know, we have millions and millions of African people stuffed into the prisons every year, every day. And we have African communities under siege with military helicopters flying around and police breaking down people's doors. Just the kind of tactics. The Israeli army is going door to door right now in Rafah and Gaza City and other places. That's just what they do in the African communities all the time here. And so as a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, under the leadership of the Uhuru Movement, the African People's Socialist Party, you know, we just have to say that Gaza is here, and until we take a stand as people sitting on the pedestal of the oppression of colonized people, until we take a stand as members of the oppressor nation, whether we like this government or not, whether we even like being oppressors or not, until we take a stand in solidarity with the struggle of African people, of indigenous people, and other colonized people right here inside the United States borders, then we're no better than an Israeli. You know, we're no better than than the oppressors that are, you know, continuing to terrorize the Palestinian people, because it's going on right here. Right.
Indeed. Right. Indeed. Uhur. I want to, you know, talk about the economic crisis that is being experienced by Israel's brutal benefactor, the U.S.
Yes.
We've got a clip of an NPR interview with retail analyst Howard Davidowitz, so I'm going to play that clip right now.
Day to Day, I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, I speak with Iranian author Azar Nafisi. She wrote the bestseller Reading Lolita in Tehran. She has a new memoir out, and it is frank and surprising. First, though, let us talk retail. Stores are still offering big discounts, hoping to get unsold holiday merchandise off the shelves. Retail analyst Howard Davidowitz is back with us. He's a Day to Day regular. Hi, Howard.
Hello.
Well, the numbers aren't in yet, but everyone is predicting that this was, at best, a lackluster season. How bad was it?
It was the worst season in 50 years. We're going to have negative GDP growth of 5 to 6. Well, we're going to have negative GDP growth every quarter of next year. When you look at this quarter, the consumer is 70% of GDP. That leaves retailing down 5 at least. It's horrendous, it's terrible, and it all comes back to the consumer. $14 trillion in debt, a 101K instead of a 401K, exploding unemployment, accelerating. We'll lose another 500,000 jobs this month. That'll bring it to 2.5 million jobs. Unemployment goes to 10% by December of 2009. So the consumer is just devastated. An $8 trillion negative wealth effect from housing. Consumer bankruptcy is dramatically on the rise. Consumers falling behind on their credit card bills, their auto loans, their student loans, their home loans. The consumer is completely inundated, and nothing good is going to happen in the near term.
Okay, so maybe I was understating it a bit when I said lackluster. Where did you get that 10% unemployment rate?
That is the forecast of our firm.
Mm-hmm.
Our firm is forecasting 10% unemployment by December of 2009. Here are the bulletproof facts. Unemployment has exploded in the last 4 months dramatically. We now have lost 1.9 million jobs. This month, we'll lose 500,000 jobs. That will bring it to 2.4 million jobs lost. That will bring your unemployment to about 6.9. Our forecast is for 10% by December of 2009, but that doesn't include millions of people on part-time work that want full-time work. It doesn't include the people who've dropped out of the labor force. When you look at those numbers, you're then looking at 14% unemployment. The word depression is not off the table. The worst is yet to come, and we think the Obama plan will do very little, do more negative than plus. So we don't really see anything good happening.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to wrest some bright spots from you. Online, it did fairly well. Amazon said this was their best holiday season ever.
Let's talk about online. It really did not do well. Amazon clearly is best in class, and they did okay. Interestingly enough, they didn't give out any sales numbers. I'm a little suspicious about that. I'm sure Amazon did okay, but let's look at the online sector. For 5 years, they've increased at the rate of 20 to 25% and clearly are the strongest sector in the retail space. However, this quarter, they will be flat to down 1% as a sector. Still better than everything else. But I would say when you've got a trend and when you're up 20 to 25 and you're flat to down 1, that doesn't look too good to me. Now, there are winners out there, of course. The consumer is trading down. So we've closed 600 Starbucks stores, and Mrs. Fields Cookies is in bankruptcy, Ponderosa's in bankruptcy, Steak and Ale liquidated, Bennigan's liquidated, Casual Dining terrible. But McDonald's hitting the ball out of the park because it's cheap and good. Coffee, $2 less than Starbucks. They're winning. Family Dollar winning. It's Walmart time. They're winning. Dollar Tree winning. The consumer doesn't have money, so they are dramatically trading down.
Retail analyst Howard Davidowitz, thank you.
Thank you for the invite.
I will quote a modern-day minstrel by the name of Flavor Flav. Wow.
Yeah.
The situation looks worse than, what was it she said? Lackluster.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Looks
right.
A little worse than lackluster. It's looking pretty bad. Penny, I want you to give us a general update on the financial news situation, but what do you think of this particular clip?
I thought it was funny because, I mean, Howard, this Howard guy is really laying it out there, but the moderator is trying to do what everybody, especially was all the media, let's say, all the bourgeois media was trying to do, especially around the Christmas holidays, was to keep things upbeat and try to find the good things, you know, to focus on in this horrendous economic situation. And he just wouldn't play that. And she was seemed a little demoralized about that. She couldn't make it an upbeat little report. So I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But in terms of the situation in the economy right now, it is extremely dire for U.S. imperialism. And one thing that I'm noticing is really that I don't even see in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the mainstream bourgeois media writing about the economy where anybody is saying or factoring in any impact that Obama's economic plan is going to have on it. So I think that if even the bourgeois media is not heralding that, I mean, he's putting out all the stuff that he's going to be doing. You think they would all be on the uptake on that, and you don't hear that. You don't hear, well, things could get better. What I do hear is that there could be what they call the Obama bounce of the stock market, which you just saw, it went up above 9,000 for the first time in several months, just I think Friday, and probably a lot, you know, even in the face of these terrible numbers for parasitic capitalism. But you know, it was probably somewhat on the belief that Obama is coming in, it's a new year, that, you know, these things are going to happen. But really, when, you know, Obama's talking about creating 3 million jobs, but the U.S. economy by the end of 2009 will have lost 4 million to 4.5 million. So he's not even talking about making up what's lost, you know, and adding into account that the job sector always has to be in growth. It always has to be growing to keep up with the numbers, you know, and also the fact that the real wages in the United States have not increased since the 1970s in adjusted for inflation. So even with jobs, people are making less money, less real money. So that is something, you know, that's really interesting to see. But One statistic I think is really striking is that the U.S. has lost 14,000 jobs a day since September 1st. And that I've heard other, commentators from different, NPR or even BBC saying that the next big impact on the economy as a whole is going to be this huge surge in unemployment, that it's just going to be devastating, especially in the United States and Britain. So, and that could be really soon, like in the next quarter, within the next quarter. And of course, there's still the talk of the fall of the dollar sometime in 2009. And a lot of people say within the first quarter of 2009. But the thing that we have to recognize is that parasitic capitalism, as we have known it inside the United States, is over. Even if Obama can do a little bit to revive this dying beast, he won't be able to bring things back or put the genie back in the bottle, mm-hmm. as the chairman says. He won't be able to do that. And it's just never going to be the same. And at best, it's going to be a slow disintegration of the economic, social, and political life as has gone on. And I think that it will inspire oppressed people, in particular around the world, to struggle more, to stand up and struggle, because they will see the vulnerabilities of the United States that will become more and more evident. It's also important to note that when we've been talking about how the bailout money, and it really now, according to Bloomberg News, this is well documented, now totals $8.5 trillion that the United States and the Federal Reserve have thrown at the economy, but not thrown at the economy, they've thrown at the bankers, mm-hmm. that this has benefited the bankers. But it has not benefited the economy. But the reality is it has hurt the economy. It has hurt the mainstream, and it will make it worse. And if you really look at it overall, what you see is that the bankers are shifting wealth into their hands. And it was, in this case, straight up donation, by the government from the taxpayers' money into the hands of the bankers. So we see this huge shift of wealth into the bankers, and because we have to remember that the bailout was passed with no regulation. Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, said to the bankers, "We hope you will do the right thing." Well, shit. I mean, when did hope ever have anything to do with what imperialism does, what parasitic capitalism does? It's based on greed and profit and self-interest of the ruling class.
Right.
No laws were changed. They're still giving subprime mortgages, by the way. And I'll say something else about that in a minute. No laws were passed. No accountability was had. These guys didn't have to come and open their books and say, they still have what's called off the books, that they don't have to show all this money. They took that money, and Paulson said, well, we'll hope you'll lend it out to smaller banks and to businesses and even regular citizens. And they haven't. They haven't done that. They're holding on to the money because they're trying to cover their bad debts based on the derivatives from the subprime mortgages. Now, they just turned GMAC, I think we talked about it a little bit last week, the finance sector of General Motors. When you buy a car, you get a loan through GMAC. Mm-hmm. They just turned that into a bank, so it could get some of the bailout money because it was doing all the same things. And what I read is that they are now giving subprime auto loans. They immediately started giving subprime auto loans anything to get people to buy these cars, even though they know they will default, really soon. They're saying that, part of the bailout was supposed to be a renegotiation of mortgages for people, homeowners. but 55% of them already have gone bad. So it's not working. It's you can't fix the economy that way. You can't fix parasitism because it's based on endless resources and endless enslaved and oppressed labor. And the world is changing. It is not accepting those conditions anymore. So Obama says he's going to rebuild infrastructure, but a new bridge, you know, in a city is not going to save the economy. You know, it's not going to, that's no permanent, the fundamentals of it are not there. So when he says he's going to jumpstart the economy, he's not going to be able to do that. Just some other things that we're seeing is that the governors of states met and put out a statement that they need $1 trillion in bailouts for states over the next 2 years. And the states are in serious, serious problem economically. Again, California, if it doesn't get a bailout of $18 billion by February, it's going to have to issue IOUs, you know, to all the state workers, which, of course, doesn't buy you very many groceries. And we've seen in 2008, 150,000 businesses closed, and 200,000 more businesses are expected to close in 2009. And New York workers, this is just interesting, have to give up, as a cutback from the city of New York, they have to give up city-owned cars, which for certain city workers, you know, that had SUVs and different kinds of cars that would go around. And that's 700 vehicles. And, of course, people are really furious about that. The arena football had to cancel because of the economic crisis. And NBA is saying it's not going to continue its series into March. So because of the economic crisis, the steel industry is in really bad shape and is asking for a bailout. The stock market is up, but still at the end of the year, but still Dow Jones for 2008 is the worst since 1931, which was the heart of the Depression. The holiday sales were the worst in 40 years. Las Vegas is asking for a bailout because gambling is down 35%. And they're closing all these hotels and stuff in Las Vegas and Reno and all the other towns in Nevada. And, you know, you would kind of think that gambling would increase, but it's not. And generally the sentiment is the economy is far worse than it seems. And just another point I wanted to make is that the breakdown of the state, this is something that I really think that we have to monitor, because the state will not be able to continue to carry out its oppressive apparatus in the same way that has always done it. And by the state, of course, we mean the structure, the apparatus of the, you know, of the ruling class that defends the interests of the ruling class, you know, in this country and around the world, like the prisons, the police, the courts, and all that. So it's interesting to note that the LA Times, Los Angeles Times, reported that U.S. executions for 2008 when the death penalty reached a 14-year low, and death sentences fell to the lowest since 1976. And the reason why is because each execution, usually of a colonized person, costs $125 million or something like that. I mean, it's really, they spend a lot of money on that. And so they're saying that they want to cut back on the death penalty, and so that they can keep funding the police. You know, but it's like the state is having to be on a budget now, on a really serious budget. And I just think that it's really important to, you know, to notice that and to recognize again that they will have to release a lot of people from prison. And that's something that, you know, it just seems like something that as the Uhuru movement or progressive people have to really push on, that because they need to be releasing all Africans and colonized people from prison.
Right.
And they're going to have to do a lot of that now. So that's some of the things that, you know, we've seen for this week.
Yeah. Okay. We're talking with Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee and author of Overturning the Culture of Violence. Would like for you all out there listening to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can do so by calling in or emailing. You can call U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. You can call our U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. That's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We have an email that came in from Ona Zane, who says, I think it should be recognized that the U.S.-sponsored Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip is a part of and at the same time a response to the crisis of imperialism. And while it is currently very much in the public eye, it is only one of the desperate parts of and responses to the crisis of imperialism. It is only one of the desperate parts of and responses to the crisis of imperialism. They are occurring throughout the world, in Haiti, Georgia, both in Europe and the U.S. with NORTHCOM, Africa, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, etc., ad infinitum. Imperialism has a very rocky road ahead. We must build and grow our organizational capacity, improve our political position, and prepare to win.
Uhuru. Thank you. Yes, I think I just really want to unite with that and, you know, appreciate that. And to say, yeah, I mean, while all of this is going on in Gaza and the eyes of the world are upon that, the U.S. Struck Pakistan border with cruise missiles just the other day during that. And we see the struggles flaring up everywhere. There's this interesting, to say the least, standoff between the Ukraine and Russia over the natural gas lines that's going on right now that's pretty serious, because 80% of all of Europe's natural gas for heating comes from the Ukraine. So, you know, this is a pretty serious thing, and it has to do with NATO and the whole struggle around, you know, the missiles pointed at the former Soviet Union Russia. And there's, you know, struggle everywhere going on in Africa, the struggle, of course, in Somalia, we'll be talking about in West Africa,
Congo.
Yeah, Congo, and you know, in the next hour. So there is struggle going on, and I think that it's a powerful time, and I unite that we have to build organization, and I say that for North Americans as well, because there's not going to be this little place that we've always been able to have on the pedestal, sort of looking down at everybody else and sort of being maybe feeling sorry about what people are experiencing down there. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that, first of all, the conditions in the United States are not going to be what they were. The standard of living, the whole social and political conditions are going to be transforming rapidly, and they already have in this last year. If we look at this past year, we would just be amazed at what changes have come about, you know, already inside the borders of the United States. So the U.S. is going to be in the thick of what millions or the majority of humanity has been experiencing, or getting closer to that anyway, for white people. So white people have to be organized, and the only way that we can be organized against imperialism and for building a new world that the Palestinians are struggling for, African workers are struggling for, indigenous peoples and all the people of Latin America, is to stand in solidarity with the African liberation struggle, which is the cornerstone of imperialism. It can't continue to exist without it, and that any system built on the backs of the enslaved, then that means that the enslaved have to lead the way in the destruction of it. And we can join that. We can be part of that. But we have to be organized. We have to stand in solidarity, you know, with the right of national liberation for African people and people around the world.
Indeed. And I think it has to be, you know, just, you know, for Africans, you know, it's not enough to sit by and watch this thing either, you know. Sometimes, you know, you talk with folks who think, well, see, it's going down. We're all right. We're going to be okay. You know, this system that does all these terrible things to us is going to be gone soon. But the reality is, if it goes in a way that is favorable for us, it will be because we made it go, because we took it out and built our own organized capacity to ensure a future for ourselves. Because the reality is, right now, imperialism has been determining the future of African people. The reality is, if imperialism goes and we have not taken if U.S. imperialism falls, Western imperialism falls, and we as African people have not taken for ourselves the capacity to determine the future for ourselves, then it'll be determined by somebody else. So it is imperative that we be organized, be part of an organization. It is imperative we build the African Socialist International. We'll be talking a bit more about that in the second half of this program. But there is no sitting on the sidelines. The only guarantee that you get sitting on the sidelines is that you don't win. That's the only guarantee you get. No matter who wins, you don't, because you weren't in the mix. And so I just wanted to say that and ask, are there any questions from the studio? Any comments from the studio?
Uhuru, I really unite with what has been said and appreciate this discussion. This is just kind of a side issue, but to just add on to the summation about the crisis of imperialism happening all over the world. I heard on the news this morning about a big fight in Russia where oil, the Europeans are mad because they say oil that's coming through pipelines that they say is supposed to be coming to Europe is being siphoned off in Russia, where they're having like the coldest winter ever or something. And you know, it's just that fight over the resources. And so the Europeans are feeling the pinch, and they're like, you know, they're not able to get the oil that they want. And, you know, it's a fight amongst the Europeans over there over that oil resource as well. And that's just another indication of the economic crisis worldwide.
Yeah. Anybody else in the studio?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's going to be an amazing year of 2009, especially for anybody that wants to see a new world, that wants to see the oppressed people come together and, you know, and live in a liberated territory, in their control over their own lives, self-determination, national liberation. That that is the genius of the people that will solve the problems of the world. And anybody who thinks that the same old imperialists, even if it's an Obama, could solve the problems that imperialism has created are crazy. You know, they don't have a clue. Only the people do. The possibilities of what can happen in a world when African people are liberated and free and have control over their lives, and the Palestinians, and the possibilities for peace and development of science and humanity. You know, it's really very inspiring just to think about. And I think that that's what's going to happen. We're in the process of that. We're in the process of that happening right now. It's a new world, you know, and white people have to make a choice. We have to say, are we going to stand with that? Are we going to be on this Titanic that's already sunk at least halfway down, you know, and keep dancing, you know, in the ballroom while while the ship's going down? Or yeah. are we going to really, really jump into what the world is going to be and what it can be and will be inevitably?
Yes. Yes. I want to also announce we talked a little bit about the invasion, the Israeli invasion in Palestine, and I want to announce that for those of you who are listening from Florida, there is an event happening at the Uhura House in St. Petersburg, Florida, on this coming Thursday, January 8th, at 6 o'clock, about the attack in Palestine, the occupation in Palestine, this massacre that's happening there. So we invite those of you listening to come and participate in that. It's going to be a forum with a panel of speakers. We anticipate speakers from the Arab activist community, as well as we'll have Chernow Alpha Mba, the director of Organization for the African Socialist International, speaking there, and other activists speaking and participating in a panel. So we invite those of you who are in the area to participate in that event. It's, again, going to be happening at the Uhura House in St. Petersburg, Florida. And the address here is 1245 18th Avenue South. And you can email us at Uhura Radio to get more information if you need it. We've got just a few more minutes left. I don't know if there's anything you want to say before we close it out, Penny.
Well, I'm just think it's a great honor to be on the forward side of history as a North American, to be able to be under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party and to be able to see the world as it really is and to recognize that, to see the world through the eyes of African workers and oppressed peoples around the world is possible. You know, we have to adopt that stand, and we can have the same understanding and this, and unite our interests with the interests of, you know, of African and oppressed people, and to see that that's the only positive thing out there in the world. And I think that this is the side of history I want to be on, and I'm proud to be part of the Uhura movement. And I think 2009 is going to be just a major, you know, step forward towards the liberation of African people and people around the world.
Right on. So we're going to go to break here, and when we come back on the second half, we'll be speaking with Chernow Alpha Mba. Again, the director of Organization for the African Socialist International, and someone who has been organizing for quite a long time in West Africa. We'll be speaking with him about the military coup in Guinea-Conakry. So stay tuned here on Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com.
But it's stupid, the young leaders we'll get for Africa here. When do they respect human life at all? So, and we know say these people that they be our papa, that they be our mama. So we got to beg them, knee. So more beg them together, I beg.
Huru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on thehururadio.com. I'm your host, Yabinga Zimbabwe, and in this second half, we're going to be talking about the situation in Guinea. Only 2 weeks ago, the imperialist puppet president of Guinea, Lansana Conte, died, and only hours following his death, a military coup was held, bringing in a new regime. We have with us Trenno Alpha Mba, the director of organization of the African Socialist International and longtime organizer as the director of the Africanist movement in West Africa. Trenno Alpha Mba was there when the military coup occurred. Uhuru, comrade.
Yes, Uhuru.
It's good to have you here in the studio with us.
Thank you very much.
To begin, military coups are not something uncommon in West Africa. Can you, before we get into this present coup, can you take us back to how Lansana Conte himself, who was the previous president, came into power?
Yes, thank you very much. Like you said, coups are not uncommon in West Africa. In fact, West Africa has had the highest number of military coups that happened in Sierra Leone and Guinea-Conakry and in Liberia. In fact, the transition, in most cases, transitions, political transitions in that part of Africa has always, you know, happened through military coups and, you know, army mutinies are rampant. So Lansana Conte himself came to power through similar circumstances in 19, you know, from 1958 up to 1984, we had the government, the progressive government of Ahmed Shekou Touré, which claimed to be a socialist government at the time, and it was it was a government that was against French and U.S. Imperialism, and Guinea within that period served as the center of the African Liberation Movement. We had Kwame Nkrumah in Guinea after the coup that overthrew him in 1966, and the PAIGC, the Party for the Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, led by Amilcar Cabral, had its headquarters in Guinea-Conakry, and some of the Southern African liberation movements were equally, like the PAC, were equally being trained. They had training bases in Guinea-Conakry. So this offended the U.S. imperialists and some of the other European imperialist nations, and we saw attempts that were made by the imperialists, led by the Portuguese, in fact, who tried to overturn the government of Guinea in the 70s, which was repelled by the Guinean government under Shekou Touré. So there were constant efforts by the imperialists at the time to overturn the government of Shekou Touré, and they did not succeed up to the point that Shekou Touré died in 1984, and then Lansana Conte, who was one of the military leaders at the time, he had fought in Guinea-Bissau and in Angola with the liberation movements. He came back and, but by then it's important for me to say that he was being sponsored by the French. Mm. And he used the opportunity of the death of Ahmed Shekou Touré to, seize power together with someone that was called Jara Traoré at the time. And I think it was like 6 months after that he too was accused of trying to overthrow Conte, and Conte killed some of the civilian politicians who connived with him to overthrow the government of Shekou Touré. So what we have been witnessing from that period, from 1984 up to the death of Conte, is a neo-colonial government that was supported by the French and the U.S., and which ruined the country and reversed some of the gains that were being made by the government, the progressive government of Ahmed Shekou Touré at the time. So it was a coup that enforced U.S. and French neo-colonialist interest in Guinea, and which gave away the strategic sector of the economy, the mining sector. In fact, we should remind ourselves that Guinea is home to the largest aluminium deposits in the world. You know, we have two leading North American corporations that are involved in the extraction of resources from Guinea, Alcoa and Alcan. So U.S. and French interest, are so entrenched in Guinea to the point that they have to make sure that any government that controls that part of Africa is one that serves their interest, and which was why a neo-colonial puppet, Lansana Conte, who had no regard for the interests of the masses, was able to hold on to power for the last 25 years or so. So, and the dictatorship that they are talking about is one that was necessitated by U.S. support, U.S. interest. They provided support for the army, and they even provided the basis for the overthrow of the PDG, the party that was Ahmed Shekou Touré's government at the time. So it was a situation, a coup that was engineered by the United States, the French, and the various imperialist nations who were opposed to the government of Ahmed Shekou Touré, and the use of Guinea as the center for the African Liberation Movement during that period in question.
Could you say something about the conditions of existence for Africans under Conte's regime for all this time that he was in power?
Well, the conditions cannot be described graphically, but regardless of the resources that we have in West Africa, because West Africa, just like any other part of Africa, is rich with diamonds, gold, aluminium, iron ore, innumerable resources. And these resources have attracted the attention of multinational corporations who have employed the services of military organizations, mercenaries, and who have worked with the neo-colonial regimes in that region to create disorder and crisis that have resulted in the deprivation of the masses for control of our own resources. So we have a situation in Guinea where people struggle to have a single meal a day, and the life expectancy is below 40 years. we have a situation where the bauxite and the aluminium resources are controlled by North American corporations that are looting the resources for the past 25 years. In fact, when Conte came to power in 1986, he allowed the IMF and the World Bank to carry out a survey which identified strategic locations where resources are located. That includes gold, bauxite, and iron ore. So some changes were made that allowed the corporations to control the economy. So what we have was that we have a political group that was in power, a political mafia organization that has depended on the protection that it receives from the corporations and the imperialists to hold on to power. So the United States government was even responsible for training of the Guinean army. So they armed the army. So Conte created, different units of the armed forces. So with the generals within the army growing rich, it was a military dictatorship that was legalized through the organization of an election in 1993 that somehow provided the notion that Guinea was being ruled by a civilian administration, which was not the case. So from 1993, the U.S. succeeded in consolidating the dictatorship of Lansana Conte because he provided unfettered access for the U.S. and North American corporations and European multinational interests in Guinea. And we have a situation where, life expectancy is low, like I said, high infant mortality rates like we have in Sierra Leone, and a situation where the masses, young people are largely unemployed, and workers are not paid. But the military, the leading officers within the army and the politicians were growing rich, through the corrupt contracts that they were carrying out with the corporations. So, like I said, the conditions cannot be described. So what we witnessed from 1984 up to December, or what we are still witnessing in Guinea, is an entrenched dictatorship, a neo-colonial repressive government that left no room for alternative political discourse, and which disarmed the people of their right to control their resources and provided the basis for endemic poverty, underdevelopment in all its forms, and one that has ensured the extraction of resources from the people for the benefit of European and North American corporations and for the corrupt neo-colonial petit bourgeoisie in that area. So this situation has created a tremendous crisis for the people, and it is so painful, and even it's beyond description. It cannot be described.
Now, one of the things that that makes this situation in Guinea interesting or a bit different than some locations is that even when Conte was alive, his regime was being seriously challenged by massive actions. Can you speak to the rebellions that happened in 2007?
Well, there has been constant efforts by the masses to overturn this dictatorship. Like I said, a year after Conte came to power, we had a situation where some areas in the country were opposed to the coup. So what he did was he arrested most of the people who he think would have developed an opposition, a solid opposition that would rally the masses against his government. And they alleged that there was a coup, a counter-coup that was being organized by some of these opposition elements. So there were several arrests that were made in 1985. And up to this point, nobody could say exactly what happened to some of those political activists. I'm talking about, over 100 people. Hmm. Nobody knows the exact number of people that were arrested by Conte in 1985. And nobody up to this point could say whether those people are still in prison or they are dead or where they were buried. So, and the United States government and the various European countries knew about it, but they did not say anything. So, there were constant efforts that were organized by the people against such a tyrannic neo-colonial dictatorship. So, what we witnessed after 1993 was an effort by the imperialists to legitimize such a dictatorship by organizing an election that was rigged in favor of Conte, and his dictatorship was entrenched in the name of so-called democracy. So, but from 1996, things became worse. You know, the government, the corruption within the government and the extraction of resources by multinational corporations have left the masses with no other alternative means of survival. So they knew that the only way to change the situation was to get rid of the government. And so, but the thing is that with the absence of an organization, a solid organization, and with the elimination of most of the activists by 1985, so we had a situation where any kind of protest was somehow disorganized. So what happened in 1996 was an attempt to overthrow the government of Conte that was done by some of the junior officers within the army. And mind you, within this period, there was already crisis in the other microstates within the region, like Sierra Leone and Liberia. Liberia was in complete chaos, just as Sierra Leone. So some of the soldiers who were fighting in some of these microstates, like in Sierra Leone and Liberia, came back home. They were not paid, and they were not their families were not taken care of. So there was an attempt that was made in 1996 to overthrow the government of Conte, which failed. So what Conte did subsequent to that, he arrested some of the officers and some other people who they alleged were part of the efforts to overthrow the government. So from 1996 up to 2007 there was a process in motion, that will build some kind of an organized protest from the people against this government that was responsible for all the contradictions that people were facing. So we have a situation where commodity prices were rising up, the economy has collapsed, people could not get access to medical care, access to good roads, the conditions that are necessary for real life, for, genuine existence. So within this period, also, the government was being challenged because there were efforts by some of the opposition elements after 1993 to organize a protest, to overthrow the government. And we even had a situation where mercenaries were hired from Sierra Leone and Liberia to carry out a rebel incursion in Guinea. But these efforts were themselves led by some sectors of the neo-colonial African petit bourgeoisie that were equally fighting for control of the economy. So it was not something that was revolutionary or something that was progressive in its character. So the alternative approach to this question was somehow is a very difficult thing, because even the U.S. and the other imperialist nations could no longer trust the government of Guinea after 2003, because this was when the Guinean government granted a mining concession in the north of the country to a Japanese corporation called GAPCO. Then the U.S. itself adopted its own strategy of overthrowing the government of Guinea by developing a program, a clandestine program for regime change in Guinea itself. So we have various forces at play in this. We have the opposition groups, and then we have the desire on the part of the masses to overturn the entire system itself, but they are not that organized in the form of an organization that we spearhead their aspirations for genuine transformation. Then the U.S. was playing with this kind of situation, exploiting this situation to its own advantage. But the thing that made it so interesting was that Conte's duration in power, what he did was that he created complementary units of the army that were loyal to him. He succeeded in dividing the army. So the army could not carry out a coup to overthrow him, because most of the generals were loyal to him. They saw the overthrow of Conte as one that meant that they too were going to lose their interest, because they were misappropriating salaries, they were growing rich, they had mansions and riding very expensive vehicles, while the junior officers were poor. They controlled the arms, so the troops could not overthrow him. So the U.S. attempt to use the army to overthrow Conte failed. Even in 2005, there was a coup that failed. And then that coup was rumored to have been sponsored by the U.S. Embassy in Conakry.
So it was subsequent to that that the U.S. developed a complementary approach. They also approached the opposition forces, the opposition parties, the opposition politicians, and they too lacked the mass support. And besides, the three main political parties in Guinea, one of them is led by a former World Bank consultant, and another one is led by a lecturer from Sorbonne University in Paris. You know, these are just forces that were tied to the various financial institutions of the imperialists. So they too were being used by the imperialists to overthrow the government of Conte, which they saw was one that was already shifting its loyalty to a different imperialist force. So, but the opposition elements could not form a coalition because they disagreed among themselves over who will lead the coalition. And besides, they do not have the mass base that will effect some kind of struggle against the government of Conte. Likewise, the army could not overthrow Conte because the generals were in favor of the government. They saw the government as one that was protecting their own interest. So you have disgruntlement within the army, but there was no one to lead the army to overthrow the government and then the opposition itself. So that was when the U.S. developed the strategy of using the trade union movement itself and the labor organization together with some of the civil society organizations to carry out a campaign of regime change against the government. So it was a very complicated situation. So the government, the Lansana Conte regime, had collapsed a long time ago. But what was needed at the time was an organization that will organize the masses for a revolutionary transformation, and which was absent. So in the absence of that, we had a situation where the various opportunistic forces were using that situation, exploiting it to their own advantage. So what we have in 2007 was some of these contradictions at play, you know, that were responsible for the the demonstrations. But the thing that made it somehow complicated and difficult, I mean, for these opportunistic forces was our intervention. Yes. Because since 2002, we have been building a movement on the ground to capture this situation. So you see, and one thing we did not realize at the time was the loyalty that the trade union movement itself had with the embassy and the U.S., the imperialist forces. So in November 2006, there was a meeting that was held in Dalaba, that's in the east of the country, during the Africanist Leadership Conference. So we had participation from some of these trade union movements, you know, and civil society organization. That was when a decision on carrying out a national campaign against the Lansana Conte government was reached. But one thing we were unable to arrive at was the nature of the coalition that was going to be formed and the plan of action that was supposed to be carried out regarding the challenge against the government. So, but by then, the trade union movement, we did not realize that the trade union movement was itself working on its own complement, on its own alternative approach that was controlled by the U.S. Embassy itself. So the agreement was that we were supposed to meet in February and then make a decision on the line of action. So immediately after the Dalaba conference, the trade union, in fact, they left us in Dalaba, and when they came to Conakry, they made a communique on the radio saying that, you know, they had given an ultimatum on the government to raise their wages and things like that. So which was a violation of the discussion that we did. And within that meeting, there were also elements within the army, some of the officers within the army who were dismissed after subsequent to the 2005 coup, you know, who were purged out of the army. And these were also forces that we are trying to, you know, overrun the government. So we thought that we could have developed some kind of a coalition that will provide the basis for mass action. You know, so this in itself was a contradiction. So what happened was that the trade union movement fired the first shots before even the plan was complete. So we were left with no option at the time but to see how we could capture the situation. So that was what made the January and February 2007 demonstrations somehow ineffective. Yes, but one thing was that it succeeded in so many ways in crippling the government, because we say that the government of Lansana Conte was overrun. You know, it was incapacitated by the in 2007. So there was a power vacuum that had existed from that point up to the death of Lansana Conte. In fact, Conte himself was already ill. Mm. 2 years ago, he was sick. He was almost dead. He was dead. So Guinea was being, yes, the announcements were not just made, but he was dead a long time ago. So the government was being run by his mafia group that he had succeeded in creating, the generals within the army, and some of the politicians who, you know, had developed some kind of a cabal, political cabal that was looting the country. Mm. So they were signing documents and giving out communiques in the name of Conte while he was oblivious of what was happening in the country by then. So you see, so there was a serious political vacuum that was in Guinea. The government was dysfunctional, and up to now, there are still areas in the country that's not under government control. Hmm. Because what the demonstrations did was that, like in Labe and in Dalaba, the police stations were burned down, you know, and so there was not like government presence in that era up to this point. Hmm. So you see, so it means that we had a situation where the government was only limited in Conakry. And even in Conakry, we had a situation where the government is not in control of the army. You know, it was not in charge of anything. So it means that somebody was to definitely take advantage of that situation, because there was nothing like a government.
Yeah.
You know, so Conte was already dead. So so you see, so these are some of the issues that made the situation in Guinea so precarious. But the government was being challenged constantly, and it collapsed completely in 2007 following the mass uprisings of January and February of that year.
So let's talk a bit. First of all, we're speaking with Chernow Alpha Mba, the Director of Organization of the African Socialist International, and organizer who's built a large base, a large movement in West Africa, and was in Guinea when the military coup occurred there. I'd like to invite those of you out there listening to participate in the discussion that we're having. You can call in or email in. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Or you can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere for free, anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So let's talk a bit about these forces who are involved in this military coup. Who are these forces?
Well, I think before we go to that, we have to examine some of the developments that were responsible for for these military forces coming to power. Because one thing is that like I said, the government had already collapsed by after the 2007 demonstrations. But the interesting thing is that there was an effort by the imperialists to consolidate their interest in Guinea after the demonstration. That was when we saw the trade union movement that was at the service of the US embassy worked to have another neo-colonialist, Lansana Kouyaté, come into power. So you see, this in itself was the outcome of the plan that was set in motion by the U.S. imperialists to secure the corporate interests of Alcoa and Alcan, the leading North American aluminum corporations in Conakry. So, but it was not the result of the aspirations of the people. It was not part of the reasons that were actually responsible for the outbreak of the rebellions. So it means that a compromise was made by the trade unions in the name of the people that was not accepted by the people. Mm. So you see, so it was something that was going to explode. We knew it, and because the entire plan was not to replace just Conte, but was to overturn the entire social system that's responsible for the oppression of the people. So you see, so it means that any kind of arrangement that does not achieve that is one that is temporal and one that is going to explode. It was an explosive arrangement that was made by the trade unions. In fact, shortly after that, even within the trade union movement, there were serious divisions, because what Lansana Kouyaté did was he appointed relatives of some of the trade union leaders and some of even the trade union members into the government. And some of them felt they were not being represented. So they started calling for renewed demonstrations, because now, you know, the choice of a prime minister perhaps to them did not fulfill the interests of all, you know, all of them. So those who felt that their interests were not represented were equally opposed to Kouyaté. So even Conte himself, the group that surrounds Conte, you know, never supported Kouyaté, because they know that, you know, they don't want him, because Kouyaté represents a different interest, and they have their own vested interest in the resources as well. So these issues combined together, resulted in some kind of into storm. So we have isolated arguments and protests. So Kouyaté could not exercise control over the whole country. He tried to organize elections to legitimize himself, but he could not do that because they could not exercise control over the whole country. For him to do that, he needed to deploy the army throughout the country. And mind you, the army itself protested against him. We had a situation where the army mutinied in Conakry for something like 2 months. They also overran the government. So there were negotiations that were done within the army. So we have serious contradictions at the time, up to the point that the Conte's political mafia group succeeded in issuing a communique in the name of Conte that dismissed Kouyaté as the Prime Minister of Guinea. So subsequent to that, we had violent protests from the soldiers as well, who they knew there was a political vacuum. So they were trying to utilize that to overthrow the government, but they did not, because they were not united around the question. So in August, the government announced that it has discovered uranium in Guinea. So that equally, stimulated the crisis, the contest among the various corporations for control of the resources. So it's like they added more crisis into the situation. So we have these competing elements. So by May, the divisions within the army has grown so sharp that the junior officers protested against the generals that they were requesting for pay. Some of them had been in the so-called peacekeeping missions in Sierra Leone and Liberia. So they were requesting like arrears that were owed to them. These were something that ran through millions of dollars, and the government could not honor that because these are monies that were expropriated by the senior army officers. So the junior officers were protesting against the senior officers. They wanted to overrun the government. There was a serious army mutiny, up to the point that everyone thought that there was a coup. So some kind of deal was brokered that ensured that some of them, were paid off, while others were still affected, and some arrests were even made. So it means that some of these elements, who we are still protesting for their salaries and who we are obsessed with the generals within the army, were working to overthrow the government. And they were working to seize the advantage of the existing political vacuum, which was not that openly glaring, almost, to the people. So the death of Conte, the announcement that Conte was dead, the confirmation that he was dead a long time ago, because we see that, announcement as a confirmation of his death, because he died a long time ago. So they just saw that now it has become open that there is a political vacuum and that it has to be filled. So this is what is responsible for them coming to power. And Moussa Dadis Camara happened to be one of the army officers that were involved in most of these coup attempts. So yes. And he fought in Liberia with ECOMOC, and then with the United Nations mission in Sierra Leone. Then he came back to Conakry. So he was one of the key forces that were leading the protest against generals for the payment of their salaries. So you see, so that is why, in fact, he was in control of the logistics, of them. And there are two camps in Conakry. One that is called the Alpha Yaya Brigade, which is made up of some of these disgruntled officers, and the Samori Touré Brigade. The Samori Touré Brigade is made up of soldiers who are loyal to Conte. And within the Samori Touré Brigade, you had the elite guards, the presidential guards, which itself is a separate unit of the army that enjoyed privileges that protected the government from being overrun. So you see, so most of, in fact, the January protest, the January and February protest was brought down by the elite brigades. So you see, so you find out that now with the collapse of Conte, it means that the elite brigade itself has lost its interest. Yes, so with that is leading a protest, it means that the army, the divisions within the army has become so sharp now. And the other two camps together with the elite brigades are not in favor of the coup. So you see, and what I just heard was that there was a communique issued by the new military regime, you know, bringing down demoting the senior officers. That if you are a general, you've been brought down to a lieutenant or something like that, because they too, you know, you can have a captain coming to power in the midst of hundreds of generals and other senior army officers. That is a contradiction within the army because, you know, the discipline is not there. So it's a very fragile situation, and that what the new military regime is trying to do is to legitimize itself. And now it's on a serious campaign of propaganda, trying to use the frustrations of the march against the Conte regime as the basis for its... because what they are saying is that there was nothing like... This is not a coup, that they had to fill in the vacuum, the political vacuum that had existed in Guinea. So, which is to say that they are trying to justify why they have to overthrow the government. So, you see, so this is the whole... But that doesn't mean that the army, because it's... The media is putting it as if it's a totality of the Guinean army that has seized power. No. The people who are in power in Guinea is just a faction of disgruntled junior army officers who had served in the so-called peacekeeping operations in Liberia and in Sierra Leone, and who felt that they were not paid what they were supposed to by the Guinean government, and that their salaries were expropriated by the generals who never fought in those wars, and that this is like a revenge. You know, is a revengeful act on the part of these army officers who exploited the existence of this political vacuum that has been created by the continuous attempts by the people to overthrow a government that's responsible for their own oppression. So it's nothing like a transformation. It is one that has increased the divisions within the army, one that has further created the basis for increased crisis, not only in Guinea, but the entire Western Africa region, because 2 months ago there was a coup in Mauritania that equally overthrew a so-called elected government. Then there were condemnations from ECOWAS and some of the imperialist forces against the coup, but you know, they could not reverse it. And then 2 months after that, there is a coup in Conakry, and we should know that, you know, this has serious implications for West Africa, because transitions, political transitions in that area, especially what they call the Mano River region, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, and even Ivory Coast, you know, for the past 5 to 10 years, is one that is that has a connection to military coups, military mutinies. So this one is equally, it will serve as a stimulant for other disgruntled elements within the army or some other groups that will equally overrun some of these fraudulent neo-colonial regimes in that region.
I want to open it up for questions. I know we have some from the studio.
Chiarno, thank you for that analysis. That was really, really excellent. And I think it's just interesting that, as you say, that's only one microstate of West Africa. And in terms of the vast wealth that's there and all the resources that imperialism, different factors of imperialism are fighting over. But my question is, when after the strike and the rebellions, the African Socialist International issued the People's Democrat, or I think it was the National Democratic Revolutionary Program, and I would like to know what was the impact of that, and how has that played out, and what are the plans of the African Socialist International and its approach to dealing this? What is the influence that it has right now in the region?
Well, you know, this is a very, like I already pointed out, that
one of the things that, you know, changed the entire outlook of the Guinea situation was our intervention in the whole efforts to effect some kind of a revolutionary transformation in Guinea, in not only in Guinea-Conakry, but in most parts of West Africa right now. So the thing is that the Revolutionary National Democratic Program came in response to the situation that we have talked about. And since that time to now, there are constant efforts that have been made to deepen unity with the program. We have been able to disseminate the program as widely as we can. And during the first West Africa Regional Conference of the African Socialist International, we examined the Guinea situation, and we came to the conclusion that the situation, before now, we have been pointing out that there's a serious political vacuum in Guinea-Conakry, and it's still there, that has to be, you know, looked into. Then we also moved a 25-point resolution, among which is that calls for an international action against multinational corporate exploitation in West Africa, the removal of foreign military presence in that region, and also the establishment of a workers' state. So you see, so it's an ongoing process, and we think that we are still examining the situation, and that our influence in that area is still being felt among the people. The Revolutionary National Democratic Program is being popularized on a regular basis, and up to now, most of the areas that we are still under, that are still not under government control, is areas that are filled with our own forces. So there is a serious division in the country, and that one of the approaches that the current regime is going to do is to carry out whatever forceful means it can to consolidate its own grip onto power. Because one thing that Dadis Kamara is saying, Musa Kamara is saying now, is that he's not interested in power, that he's going to leave after 2 years. But if he's not interested in power, then why did he take power in the first place? So, he is trying to rally the various new colonial regimes in the region to support his consolidation of power in Guinea-Conakry. And it's in their own interest. There has been meetings that have been held between the illegitimate regime in Conakry with that of Abdoulaye Wade in Senegal, who himself is an imperialist puppet. And then he even provided a plane, an Air Senegal flight that took the military representative of the military government to Liberia and then to Sierra Leone. 2 days ago, they were heading for Mali. So they know that they have not succeeded in exercising their efforts, and that there is a uniform dynamic in the whole region that makes, you know, instability in one of those micro states, you know, it has a possibility of rapidly spreading into other areas. And I know that there are constant efforts on the part of the masses to organize for self-determination, that we are struggling for self-determination, because the 23-point resolution, they just concluded West Africa Regional Conference of the African Socialist International received tremendous publicity, even from the imperialist media itself. So these are not strange efforts. These are efforts that are known to them. And some of these forces know that these complementary efforts are underway. And they know some of us, because three of them that are currently in the government are forces that we know. You know, that are, you know. So it is, like I said, we hope that, you know, there's going to be, this provides the basis for some kind of activity that will result into genuine transformation, if anything. We stand a lot to benefit from the ongoing situation. I think that the efforts to consolidate the national committees of the African Socialist International and the regional work that we are currently putting in motion on the continent is one that is directly in response to this ongoing situation. But the influence of the Revolutionary National Democratic Program is there, and that people are expressing unity with the whole thing. So we are currently developing a national campaign of mobilization for Sierra Leone, Liberia, and in Guinea-Conakry, which will capture, which will rally the masses you know, in order for us to see what we can do to overturn the situation. But like I said, even the military is not united. It's not the totality of the army that has taken power right now. It's a very minute faction, very disgruntled element that is trying, you know, day in and day out to consolidate its hold on to power. And they've been holding meetings with some of the trade union movement. In fact, some sections of the trade union movement itself have expressed unity with the army, while others, as I'm speaking right now, in fact, when I was in Conakry, before the announcement of the coup came up, I received a call from one of the trade union leaders saying that they are trying to pull a coup. So you see, so some of their leaders are currently out of the country. They are in various parts of West Africa. So they too know that this is not a solution. So what we are struggling for is the unification of these progressive elements so that we can move the struggle forward. But it provides tremendous opportunities for us to move forward.
Are there any other questions in the studio before we move forward? Go
ahead. Oh, yes. I had a question about the trade unions, what kind of influence then, who they represent in terms of, because you were saying about the extensive unemployment, and is it primarily representing the mining sector workers? And also in talking about, okay, because we're here in the U.S., you know, in talking about the imperialist military forces, I think you had spoken in the past about FBI offices in Freetown, and I was wondering, with now the establishment of AFRICOM, how are you seeing that play out on the ground in terms of U.S. Direction, and do you anticipate anything in particular with the incoming president in the U.S.?
Well, I will start with the question on the trade unions. I don't think that the trade unions have any legitimate control over the masses anymore, because proven out during the demonstrations in Guinea, because the trade unions called for the protest to be put down, but that did not happen because they have to rely on the army to do that for them. So you see, so you cannot have an organization that claims to represent people, and then if it calls people into motion, then it says, no, you have to back off, then the people refuse. So, and the army has to step in. So many people were killed. And the thing is that when the trade unions issue out a statement, they are just struggling for their own individual interests. Mm. We have situations where trade union leaders will only go into action when they want appointments or maybe monies to be given to them. Right. So they compromise their stance based on whatever meetings they had with the government that's in power. So it is not a legitimate organization. And they are just using the contradictions to enhance their own individual objectives, and that is what they did with the January and February demonstrations. But that doesn't mean that there are some elements within the trade union movement that are progressive, because as I'm speaking right now, some of them have fled the country for fear of been arrested because they are opposed to the coup. So you see, it is going to take some kind of leadership from our part to unite all the progressive elements within these organizations so that we can push forward the Revolutionary National Democratic Program, which is key towards the actualization of our mission in that region. Well, regarding AFRICOM and the increased Western military presence in the region, I think that with the unfolding situation, that's why they are worried. Because this is one of the reasons why they have these intelligence agencies on the ground, because now, left as it is, the neo-colonial governments could not rely on their own military and security forces to provide the protection that they need. Because even in Sierra Leone, there is a contradiction within the security forces, because the government could not trust the army. And what they are doing now is disarming the army, you know, and then rearming the police. They have created a special wing of the police force that has arms, because usually the police in Sierra Leone don't carry arms. So now they have a special armed wing of the police force that are trained by the British. So it is like, you know, there is a new approach towards securing the new colonial governments in that area. And this is part of the strategy that's been advanced by the FBI and the British Army and police in the region.
So what I will see is that with the unfolding situation, there is going to be increased deployment of Western military forces in that area to protect the governments, because they are very, very vulnerable with this situation in Guinea right now. So, in fact, for every coup, is one that is engineered by the contending interest among the various multinational corporations for control of the resources. Like in Guinea now, there are serious contest between Western capitalist corporations and some of the emerging Asian corporations, the Chinese and the Japanese and things like that. So you see, so this is going to fuel a contest, and the security forces are going to be used as proxies to carry out some of these things. You know, like in Sierra Leone, for a very long time, the government has not depended on its own indigenous army. In fact, Sierra Leone, the government had bitter experiences, because in 1997, we witnessed a situation where the entire army, national army, united with the RUF against the government. So they had to bring in various military forces from various West African states, like Nigeria, Guinea-Conakry, and Mali, to fight to protect the government of Ahmed Tidjane Kabah at the time. And they were being funded by the British, even to the point that the British had to send in their own troops to protect the government for a concession in Kono. So we are going to witness the same kind of trend. That's what I will see. And with AFRICOM, it gives them now the opportunity to create a base on the ground as part of the effort of reinforcing some of these intelligence agencies and military deployments that are already there.
Now, can you? That brings to mind another question, and that is: can you tell who's behind these forces who have taken power now?
Well, right now it's too early to say, but what we know that for every coup, like I have already said, you know, we have serious contending interest in Guinea-Conakry from 2003, when the government of Lansana Conte ceded the contract to the Japanese. There was an attempt by the U.S. government to overthrow the government to secure their interests, and they succeeded in getting Lansana Kouyaté as the prime minister. Then, subsequent to that, we have a declaration on the Guinean government. In August 2007, the government announced that they have discovered a viable reserve of uranium. So you see, so this will equally attract other corporations that will contend for control of the resources. And that one way they will have to do that is by ensuring that the government represents their interest. So like I said, it's early to say, but we have to see how the situation unfolds within the next couple of weeks. For now, we know that there has been, as usual, hypocrisy on the part of the imperialist forces, because they won't say we support the government. What they said is that they are opposed to the coup. But they are not saying they are opposed to the coup, but they are saying that a civilian administration should be restored. that they are calling for what they call legitimate process. And the military themselves are saying that, but there is no legitimacy, because the government that was in power was not legitimate. So if the government that was in power was not legitimate, then it was a government that was initially protected by the U.S. and the French, then we should expect that it's the contending interest among these imperialist forces that is responsible for the coup. Mm-hmm. So it might be, largely, we might say for now, it might be a U.S.-sponsored coup for the control of for the protection of the interests of Alcoa and Alcan, but we have to see how it turns out. We know that some of the new colonial governments in the region have already expressed unity. Like Senegal, for instance, have expressed its calling for recognition of the regime, and the governments in Sierra Leone haven't said a word, but they have had meetings, what they call closed door meetings with the government. So. It is definitely tied to Western imperialist interest, for sure.
What is the solution for the people of Guinea?
Well, we have said this. We continue to say this openly, that the solution is the African Socialist International, and we have been working on this process. We know that the current situation in West Africa is largely influenced. The dynamism in West Africa is largely influenced by the work that we are currently doing. And that the increased military presence, Western military presence in the region, is a response to some of that work. So we think that
the only solution is for the people to organize themselves, to have an organization that represents their interests. In this case, we are talking about the African Socialist International. There is already a Revolutionary National Democratic Program that has been put on the ground in Guinea, and it is the only solution to the crisis, not only in Guinea, but throughout West Africa and in most parts of Africa now. So we are in the process of rapidly organizing the African Socialist International and providing leadership to the struggles of our people for self-determination. So we believe that, like I said, this situation provides us with the opportunity of, of moving our program forward. And the only solution is the African Socialist International, the organization that's capable of uniting these separate struggles into a common direction, and which is what we are doing. In fact, it is not surprising that the situation is happening this way in Guinea. It's something that we expect, and it's one that is going to turn out to our own advantage, we are sure.
So how do people in the region get tied to the African Socialist International? I know there was a recent conference.
Yes, we have already established a West Africa Regional Committee of the African Socialist International. And then we have consolidated the Sierra Leone National Committee of the ASI, and we are working on the consolidation of the National Committee of Guinea, which we are supposed to do before now, and there are plans already in motion to do that. And we have developed a strategy for the rapid mobilization of the masses in that region. And we have plans to carry out a national mobilization of workers and peasants, so that will culminate into the holding of a national workers and peasants summit in Sierra Leone, and then in Guinea and in Liberia as well. So these summits will attempt to develop a solid coalition of progressive forces, democratic forces around the Revolutionary National Democratic Program. Then they will take a decision on the actual implementation of the program now, because the mobilizations will be part of the effort of reaffirming their unity with the program, and then the summit will be part of the effort of moving on a decision on the implementation of the program. So what we are going to witness, we are sure, is a mass action for the implementation of the program, at minimum one that will be regional or maybe a national protest against multinational corporations and Western military presence in the region as part of the process of enhancing the Revolutionary National program itself. So these are some of the steps in motion. So we believe that Africans in other parts of the world equally have a responsibility of understanding that they have a responsibility in enhancing the effectiveness of these campaigns. So the way it's turning out now, it requires increased level of commitment, increased level of mobilization, and effort that will give us the capacity and the ability to move forward with such a program.
We've got just a few minutes left, and we've got a question that came in. I'm going to ask this last question, and it says, appears that imperialism is consolidating in Liberia through the current president. Given that Liberia is part of the immediate triangle, Conakry, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and the fear of a domino effect where there's a spillover, can you say something about any serious opposition to the current government in Liberia? And can you speak on the relationship and significance of the African struggle on the continent to African pro-independence worldwide?
Well, like we've already said, the connection, in fact, the crisis in Liberia started with the efforts of the imperialists to consolidate their interests. We've been talking about that for the last 2 years or so. So the current president of Liberia has been during the last meeting, is currently the head of what they call the Mano River region. The neo-colonialists in that region have their own organizations protecting their own interests. So there was a meeting that was held recently between the government of Liberia and the illegitimate military regime in Guinea, which has just come to power. So if anything, it is a government that is very, very fragile, just like the other areas. But there is no
serious opposition to the government, because the only thing I know is that there are several ex-combatants in Liberia who are disgruntled, who were tied to Taylor, who are opposed to the treatments that Taylor is receiving currently in The Hague, who might use whatever opportunity that they have to overrun the government. That's one. And besides, Liberia is currently the center of indigenous mercenaries within the region who are being recruited by other opposition elements in other parts of the region to fight in some of the neighboring microstates in Ivory Coast. Even during the January and February 2007 protests in Guinea, the government of Conte brought in mercenaries from Liberia. So when the coup happened, the government of Liberia issued out a communique immediately calling on what they call Liberians, Africans in Liberia, not to be involved in any unfolding situation in Guinea-Conakry. So they know that there is constant efforts that have been made, led by us, specifically African Socialist International, to organize the masses around some of these questions of self-determination. So it's a vulnerable regime. All of them are vulnerable, and they do not rely on their own forces. There is no solid indigenous military force in Liberia. The Liberian government is currently protected by the United Nations Army in Liberia. So that is why Ellen Johnson Sirleaf herself has allowed for the deployment of AFRICOM in Liberia as part of the effort of providing protection for her government. So you see, It is a vulnerable regime. So, and for every instability in one of those areas, has a propensity of escalating and creating chaos for the entire region, and they know that.
Well, we're out of time now, but I want to first of all thank you, Mafika Cherno Alpha and Ba, for coming in and participating with us today.
Yes. Before we go, I think we should emphasize that Africans everywhere should know that the struggle in West Africa is part of the